Hi, and welcome to episode 13 of the Machine Ethics Podcast. This time, we're talking to Demetrius Brinkman. Demetrius and I talk about what ML and MLOps is, productionizing machine learning models, narrow machine learning and how it's still relevant, coding agents, talking to your computer, and the unknown productivity gains of ML agents, chat and those one-dimensional interfaces as a bastion of all knowledge, and possibly the internet eating itself. If you like this episode, you can actually listen to more of Demetrius and I talking as I was on an episode of Are You a Robot back in 2021. So go and see series 6 and episode 7 of that podcast. We also have many more episodes on the machine-ethics.net. You can contact us, hello@machine-ethics.net. You can follow us on Blue Sky, machine-ethics.net. Instagram, Machine Ethics Podcast, YouTube at machine-ethics, and if you can, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machine-ethics. Thank you very much and hope you enjoy. Thank you, Demetrius. Thanks for coming on the podcast. And could you say who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I'm incredibly grateful that you brought me on here. I started the MLOps community in 2020. And I also have done a little stuff around AI ethics back in the day. I think that's how we met each other when I was hosting the Are You a Robot podcast. I'm a huge fan of podcasts. I have the MLOps community podcast. I like coming on other people's podcasts and blabbing. Sometimes I tell people that I'm just a professional talker, not a professional speaker. But the community grew. I wouldn't necessarily attribute all the growth to myself. The MLOps community has grown since 2020 till now to be, we boast that there's like over 150,000 developers, all really focused on AI and machine learning. And that is, that's kind of the TLDR of myself.
Yeah, wicked. I mean, I was going to go in with, are you a robot, right? Because that's how we first had a chat. And I was looking back at it now, and it was 2021, I think. So 4 years ago, exactly, pretty much, we spoke. Yeah. And at that point, you're obviously doing that podcast, which is more the ethics-y side of AI, ML stuff. And then you also had your community, right? The MLOps community. So I was wondering, because our listeners might not be completely aware of like some of these acronyms. So like, what is ML? What is MLOps? I'm pretty sure that we've talked enough about AI in this podcast. So maybe if you could just kind of discern what those are to you. And after that, it's kind of like, how has that changed? Like since we've been chatting in the last 4 to 5 years?
So ML is what we used to call AI, I guess, before AI became cool. Machine learning is the algorithms that were the predictive algorithms before the advent of large language models and deep learning and all of that fun stuff. And so the ML ops of it, especially in the early days when the community was starting, until ChatGPT came out and had its moment, is the act of productionizing machine learning models. So taking a machine learning model and then putting it into production. And you can think of machine learning models as the algorithms that power your recommendation engines. So when you go on Netflix and you see different thumbnails or YouTube and you see different videos coming up, those are powered by traditional machine learning models as opposed to a ChatGPT style large language model. And getting those into production is actually quite hard because you've got to focus on a lot of different pieces. Not only do you have to create the model, which we don't do as much now because we can just hit an API and get a response from Claude or OpenAI, but you had to have the data to create that model, and getting that data from your company or the users on your website, knowing what different features about the users are going to influence and give the best predictions to different models was very important. And then deduplicating data, cleaning data, all of that. There was a lot of headaches in those days. And since has evolved quite a bit, A, because a lot more hype and interest and energy is going into building AI and AI agents and using AI agents. But also since the MLOps early days, these machine learning models and that whole headache of the data acquisition and processing, pre-processing, all that fun stuff, and then training the model and then putting the model into production and observing the model and that life cycle that you had, it has been around long enough to let the field mature. And so the things that were hard in 2020 are not as hard anymore. And I'm not going to say it's a completely solved field, but it's not so new, and it's not like we're encountering the problems for the first time anymore.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. That's obviously, it wasn't a thing, and then it was suddenly a thing, and then that thing has been around for a little while now. You know, we've been trying to work with these algorithms, machine learning algorithms. What was interesting, what you said, is that obviously things have changed, but like, are you still doing some of that stuff? Are you still obviously productionizing and trying to get the data and trying to fit it and trying to clean it up and all that sort of stuff and put models into production? But are you putting models in production, you know what I mean, anymore? Are you, and are those models just very niche, or like, you know, what's changed there? Because that's quite interesting to me.
I like to say that the dirty little secret of AI is there's still a ton of money being made with these traditional ML models. If you think about any being made or being saved, I guess you could bucket it into these two different areas, because you have a lot of use cases that are using traditional ML, i.e. the recommender systems. So recommending things that you might want to buy next on any e-commerce website. And then fraud and predicting if something is fraudulent, that's all powered by these models still. There are different folks who are trying to incorporate large language models or the transformer models into their fraud systems and leveraging that on top of the machine learning models. But for the most part, because of the latency requirements that you have with fraud and recommender systems, you kind of are in this catch-22 where you can't quite use the LLM, even if it does give you a better result. But there's some cool creative ways that folks are trying to do that. Same with the recommender system. Like if you go on to your favorite social media app right now, the whole timeline, that's all a recommender system that's powered by machine learning models, traditional machine learning models. However, there's folks at these different social media companies that are trying to say, well, what if we just give, what if we let a large language model decide what you see next? How would that look? Yeah. And I haven't seen anybody who's done it totally well yet.
And like, just for people who were interested and want to look this stuff up, right, I'm going to make a very broad definition of these things. Like a large language model, these are usually large, right? So the, you can't train these things yourself. Like you have to have a lot of data, you have a lot of compute, a lot of energy to do that. So that's not like open to most people, but you could access either through a service or an open source model that has already been made by someone, and you could use that. And that's at its bare bones, that's a structural, it's a neural network, right? In a certain structure. Whereas when you're saying traditional, are you just saying like small neural networks and the tree, the random forest, the XJ boost, all these sort of different, because obviously there's just loads of different algorithms you could use, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just the different architectures of these models. And the large language models, I think, these days are pretty much all transformer-based architectures. And then these other architectures that you mentioned are what we would call quote unquote traditional machine learning models, and they tend to be smaller. They also tend to be much faster, and they tend to be trained by the companies themselves because they don't take months to train like the transformer based models that have billions of parameters.
Yeah. And they usually have like one job, right? Just...
Yeah.
Yeah. Fraud detection. That's it. That's exactly. All that. This thing's for fraud detection, nothing else. And it does it really well. And it does it, like you said, fast and hopefully on a computer, which isn't the size of a cathedral, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So it's been fascinating though. I mean, going back to the question on how has it changed, like are people still using this? Are they not? And what is the MLOps community doing? Because we started with that, and that was really the main thing that we would talk about is, hey, there's this really confusing kind of cryptic thing of putting machine learning models into production and then making sure that they continue to perform in the ways that you would want them to. But then as AI became bigger and bigger and it became more of our life cycle, you know, then first it was, well, now what do we build on top of API calls that are just pinging out to an LLM? Can we create apps that leverage LLMs? What does that look like? There's this new world of products that we can create with apps or with AI. And then it was, okay, well, how do we get AI into production? What does productionizing AI look like? And then it was, well, actually, we don't want to just talk to a chatbot and learn things. We want the AI to go and do things. So then advent of agents came about and we started talking about, okay, well, how do we productionize agents? And now more recently, probably in the last couple months, I would say since November last year, now we're in May, so maybe 6 months ago, I've just been on a kick of the coding agents because that's where I'm having the most fun. I don't know if you've played around with them at all, but there's so much innovation going on that level that it's too cool for me not to go and look at. And so I'm not going to say like, oh, it's following the pattern of, well, coding agents in production, because it's very much not that. It's this whole new thing of how are we using AI to leverage the software development lifecycle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And were you a coder before?
Not really. I knew enough to get myself into a few pickles, but I wasn't that good. And now I'm still not that good, but I have the superpower of being able to make things and explain what I want good enough to actually create what I need to create.
Mm-hmm. I feel like you can come at it from lots of different directions, right? So if someone who doesn't code, they could ask it to make something, and more or less it might produce something which is roughly a thing, but maybe they misinterpreted, the agent misinterpreted what they wanted, or it was underspecified, whatever. They can have a chat, it changes, updates, whatever. But if you were a coder, like myself, you might care about actually what it's producing or the way it's producing. So you can kind of almost over-specify, weirdly. You can be like, oh, I want to use fast API, and I want to use in Python, and I want you to back it with this kind of database, and I want you to and provide all this kind of detail, which is also interesting because it might not be the best route. You know what I mean? You never know. Like, yeah. Whatever. Not that I'm saying that these agents know what the best route is. Mm-hmm. You know, they might just produce what is mostly used, therefore that's the best for them. But yeah, it's just interesting that you know different people using it in different ways get, you know, getting different things out of it.
100%. I've heard, well, I'm sure you're familiar with the term vibe coding.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then you also have the term agentic engineering, and I look at that as like two ends of a spectrum. basically people who have no idea and are just going in and throwing in a prompt and then letting something come out on the other side. That would be vibe coding. Agentic engineering is, if you really want to take it to the max, it's like paralyzing five different agents on the same task, and then whichever one passes the test the best, it is the one that you merge to the code repo. And you've got lots of cool innovation happening with some pretty serious engineers that are trying to push it to the max. And so that's where I feel like there's the most fun to be had in this world. And I think that, to your point, like, yeah, we may not know if this is the best way, the way that we want to do it is the best way, or we just let the agent do it. The cool thing is that now code is so dispensable that it's not like you have to be very protective of when you write something, because if it takes, let's say on the longer end, a few hours to create, that's a whole different scenario than if it took you 2 weeks to create for the same feature. So you can create the same feature in five different ways in the time that before it may have taken you to create that feature in one way.
Yeah, and I guess this stuff also is like you're saying, to start with, it's like a different ability, because you still, like, if you're producing a recommendation system or something like that, it's still that system that you're trying to get to, but you're getting help, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, yeah, like you know where you're going, and it's this pair programming, maybe, you know, in traditional programming, you might have someone looking over your shoulder and helping you out, situation, but that's now kind of automated and you're collaborating sometimes, you're checking other times and you're specifying sometimes, you know, all this sort of things.
Yeah, I've had so much help too from getting skills that other people have written. And I found them on GitHub repos, which, by the way, is not the best practice on the security side of things. But for like some of the very known skills, I've checked into the creators of them, I trust enough, like the superpower skills, or there's even one, I think it's like a grill me skill.
But these are human readable, right? They're like markdown files. They're not like...
So yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Skills themselves are what an agent can use and it can invoke to know when to do something and how to do it. So going back to your point, whenever I build something, I will use the brainstorming skill, and that will make sure to just continuously ask me questions about what it is I want to build and why I want to build it. Why do you want to do it that way? What are you trying to accomplish? And it gives so much more context to the agents, and you're able to come out on the other side with a great product because you've front-loaded the heavy lifting of the context. The other little trick, just as a side note of giving context to your agents, using a speech to text tool, so basically a transcription tool, when you're like giving all the context, is incredible, because I find that I am so much more willing to just blabber on about things when talking as opposed to typing. And so you can context dump with talking into the prompt, and then you're getting questions back and you context dump even more and even more. And so you're really like willing to give that context in those moments when you're talking. And that goes for AI products too, which is funny. I've seen different companies try and incorporate this into their AI products, because if the AI models are going to perform better with more context, well, what if we create a voice mode so that we can really bypass the shyness or just the laziness of the user to give us the context that we need.
Yeah. So it's like less of these fingers and more just, and do you feel like, I mean, is that future? Are we going to sit around in the office and like talk to our computers? You know what I mean?
I definitely do it now. I don't know about you, but I'm like, I am so lazy for typing. And I've also seen, I don't have this, I just have it as a hotkey on my keyboard, but I've heard of people who just have like MIDI pedals for guitars and stuff, mm-hmm. and they'll use those as their hotkeys, so they don't even have to press anything on the keyboard. They just press the pedal, mm-hmm. and boom, it turns on the transcription. They're able to transcribe what they need, they say what they need, and then they're back.
Yeah, that, I feel like it, for some reason I've just got Wall-E in my head, right? Just all these people kind of lying around, just kind of obese people who don't do anything, but
talk to the machines.
Go and do that thing, please. I'm just having a milkshake.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Yeah. I think, I don't know. If it feels like maybe I'm in a minority where I'm still. Because I'm also working in an office, so I don't feel like I can just spend all the time talking.
Yeah, that part's a little bit weird.
It's just strange.
I hear you on that one. And it's not like you want to spend the whole day in the phone call cubicle.
Yes.
Whatever they're called these days, I don't even know.
Yeah. The phone pod or something.
Yeah.
Meeting. Yeah, exactly. And then there's like, I don't know, there's this kind of like, mental model thing going on there where if you talk to a lot of academics about it, like teachers and stuff, they're like, or like people who are passionate about writing and stories and things like this, they're like, yeah, like writing is a tool for thinking, right?
Yeah.
So you write things down, you rewrite it, you edit it, and you think about both what you're writing and the process of writing and the process of getting down what it is that you're trying to say. I wonder if you feel like that's just completely fine, that maybe it's more of a stream of consciousness thing that you're getting into, but maybe that back and forth is helping.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. There's a few great books by... is it Stephen King, but under his like other pseudonym, one's on writing. Mm. And then the other is something like Good Writing, Good Thinking. Or, I can't remember the name of it right now. I have it on my bookshelf though. Maybe later I'll send it to you to put in the show notes. And the ideas that they present in that book is 100% what you're talking about. One is on writing is just more about how to write well. And what I notice is there's different buckets of ways that we write these days. A lot of our daily writing comes in the bucket of a WhatsApp message, a Slack message, a LinkedIn message. It's back and forth messages.
Mm, yep.
And I happily get rid of that type of writing from my life, because in general, it's a text of two or three lines. And so even though I'm saving maybe a second by not writing it, it makes me feel like I'm the most productive guy in the world. And so that's another funny thing with the perception of how much productivity gains we have with AI. This one makes me feel like I'm getting the most out of my AI tools, and it's just shaving off maybe milliseconds from my actual workflow.
Yeah.
But then on the other side, you've got the bucket of deep writing. I'm trying to write memos, or I'm trying to really inform my thinking with my writing. And so on that point, I still will do huge brain dumps, or I will try at least to brain dump as much context as possible, And sometimes I'll just turn on a transcription tool, or I'll record myself and go for a walk and then blab and blab and blab.
Yep.
And let everything come out. And other time, and then you can throw it into AI and say, like, here, organize these thoughts. Don't write the actual thing, just organize the thoughts and then give me some kind of an outline. And then you go back and forth. But I find it to be great as a sparring partner in that way. And again, going back to the brainstorming, this time not in a brainstorming skill, but more just helping me stress test my ideas. I will use it to context dump and then write what I want to write. But it's really, you need to spend the time with the actual writing or the written material. And then you have to still internalize and think about it. And I haven't found that AI generated memos or documents yet will get you all the way there.
Yeah. So you're still kind of having to think that through, but the process is slightly different.
Yeah.
You did a talk, which is on YouTube, which mentions the limits of text. And I felt like after watching that, I was like, oh yeah, I should definitely speak to you about this whole thing. Because obviously the ML ops, community situation, and I just like the fact that you had a strong opinion about where we were at, basically, and where we might be headed. So do you think we've got this thing, but we're still kind of on the precipice of, there are other ways of interacting, there are other kind of killer apps that we could make with this sort of technology? How do you feel about that sort of situation?
100%. The funny thing about that is, since I gave that talk, that was like 8 or 9 months ago, there's been some updates that I would say are, for me, they feel like they're going in the right direction. And the context on the talk is that, yeah, I said chat isn't the interface that is going to really stick. I'm not a fan of the chat-based interface only, although I use it every day. I feel like the language and us having to say words for certain use cases is just like one of the worst ways that we can execute what we want. And so what are better ways? Well, ways that we've been interacting with machines for a while now, like having a slider or having a picker, or ways that we can get much more precise in what we're looking for. And also then when data comes back at us, if it's just text all the time, that isn't the best way for us as humans to interpret data. And so on that front, I've seen some cool stuff happen with MCP apps, and ChatGPT had this back in the day too. I think it was called something different, and I can't remember what it was exactly, but now any company can have, and it might be called MCP UI. Forgive me if I'm totally butchering this, MCP apps or MCP UI. But what happens is me as a company, I can say, when you present my data inside of the chat window, you present it like this. So I can have a bit more control of how the agents are presenting my stuff. And so if you have a lot of visual data that you want to show the user, you can do that with your branding and your way that you specify. So that's cool, because a lot of things I said in the talk were, you know, we don't get sliders, or we don't get voice memos back, or podcast clips when we want something. We just get text, and that is a little frustrating sometimes, because I want richer media back from my agents. But then there's a whole nother aspect that I was saying, which is that the chat right now is like the browser was back in the early 2010s in that it's your gateway to the internet. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but I will lean on the chat much more than I lean on any other type of navigation for the internet. So what that means is that I want to have this chat be able to go and do things now for me. But if everybody is trying to be the one chat to rule them all, then we're creating these little silos. And me as a company, especially if I'm a big company that has a lot of weight behind it, like an Amazon, I'm not going to want my whole user relationship and experience to be disaggregated from me because someone is coming and getting all of their information about the products on Amazon through some other chat window.
So you've got this disconnect between the brands and the user of the brands who might be looking up a recipe, or they might be looking at sneakers, you know, all different kind of tasks, but they might do that through a chat interface.
And you as this marketplace, aka Amazon, you probably are used to having all of the information about that user so that you can recommend them the next best thing. But what happens when they're getting all of that information through a chat window? Well, now you say, well, I want to have my own chat. And so that people interact with the internet through my chat so I can keep that data and I can know what the user needs. But what that gives us as the users is a pretty poor user experience, because now I can't have my agent, my one agent that I'm ready to go and do everything across the internet for me with. I can't have it go and do that because Amazon says, no, if you want to interact with me, you got to come to my agent. You can't do it through another agent. And so you're getting these walled gardens, and next thing you know, you're like, all right, well, actually, it's not that interoperable for me to have this one agent in the chat interface that goes off and finds things and does things and then brings it back to this chat that I have. So that was some of my gripe. I do feel like, though, we're moving in the right direction. I will say that since I gave that talk 8 months ago, it does feel like there's been a lot of progress made. And the fact that Amazon doesn't make me use Rufus to do shopping on Amazon is kind of a good sign, I guess.
Yeah. And Rufus is the Amazon.
The Amazon chat, I think.
That's it. Do you remember the time when Meta had the M Messenger agent? Do you remember that?
I know they had Meta AI, and I saw it pop up occasionally in WhatsApp. And I would like accidentally hit on it and get angry.
You'd be like, "What is this for?" I remember like there's this sort of like smoke and mirrors thing back when they introduced the Messenger M in Messenger, and it was like you could ask it anything, but backing it was people, right? So it's like Wizard of Oz situation. So I find it hilarious, because it's like, how much, like, because of the Amazon thing, right, how much of this is just like we just need to appear like to our shareholders that we are doing something which is cutting edge or useful or whatever, and we could just not do it, just don't do it. We could just not bother. We'd do something much cheaper, because we could just rip off one of these other models and put a thing on it. I don't know.
Did you see the tweet? This reminds me of something I just saw recently, where it was somebody tweeting out, "We've now started to hire entry level data analysts to combat the high costs of our token maxing." something along those lines. So it's like, oh, great. So it's gone full circle now.
Yeah. You're spending too much money so you can hire cheap people. Yeah. People are cheaper.
Tokens have become too expensive. People are just going crazy with what they're asking these agents.
Because if you think about it, if you just gave some food and water to the person, then you can get tokens out of them, right? That's the the situation. Yeah. I think there's an anecdote mine that we can go down here. That's what I was going to ask. We're talking about the coding agents, and we're talking about agents and chat windows and stuff like that. Just so people are not bamboozled, for you, where do these things live? Do you go to the website of Claude? Do you have something downloaded? How does that work?
I try and interact with it any way that I can, just to know what is out there. Mm. And so this means that I'll use the native apps, whether that's a native Claude app or Anti-Gravity, which is the IDE for Gemini, or you've got the ChatGPT app. And then also I try and do things, if it's coding agent stuff, I'll try and use Claude Code in the terminal. And I also have messed around with different... The cool thing is now it's I can just tell the coding agent, I want to use this open source repo, or I want to use this open source IDE. Mm. Go download it and set it up for me, and it'll do all that. And so I've now started trying to play with things that maybe before I was a little more apprehensive about, because it would be I don't want to learn this, or I don't want to spend the time to download it, and then there's a learning curve type thing. Now it's if I get stuck, I can always just ask the AI that's behind this.
Yeah. And it will, it can't help but have an opinion about it, right?
Yeah.
whether it's true or not, I don't know.
Which is the hard, that's one of the hardest parts about building the products behind it, is making it say, I don't know.
Or I don't have context for this, or enough information, or the data isn't available, or the event hasn't happened, or whatever it is. Yeah. Are you getting I want to say very not power user at the moment, because I have an aversion in certain directions. I was doing kind of a history of AI, a series of talks in pubs in the UK earlier on this year, which is nice, because people can get rowdy and I can get rowdy back at them. Part of that research, I was really hard, because it's the ground truth is it was always difficult to get ground truth. Mm-hmm. And now you're getting ground truth missing, you're just getting this person from the 18th century was a painter, and they painted pictures like this. And it's and you look them up and it's apparently this person's an author and they talked about this. But I can see why you got confused about that. But then it's being presented as authoritative information, which just struck me as there needs to be a grounding thing. And I thought that maybe academic research could be the grounding thing, but I think maybe that ship's already sailed, because people are using it.
And it's so hard too, because you have so many conflicting opinions, even within academic research or the greater population, on what happened. It's the subjective nature of the reality that we live in, right? So it's very difficult to say this is the ground truth.
But there's certain things that you can say, is the president of the United States Donald Trump? There's certain things which are there are truisms, because we have made them true. They are currently the case. I'm trying to work out what the factual name for that is. And there are other things which are debatable, right? So I think as long as you just need some way of interrogating what is what is generally known to be true,
mm-hmm.
and what is up, which is debatable or not, which is an interesting problem that we find ourselves in now, given that this interface is strongly one-dimensional and it doesn't necessarily give us all the context back unless we ask it or force it to try and tell us when it doesn't know something. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not made like that, essentially.
You know, I used to not really understand the quote that I heard quite a bit growing up, which was, the history books are written by the winners.
Mm.
And it feels like we're very much in that time. Like, all of the stuff that AI is trained on is the history books that have been written by the winners. So even if it wasn't like that,
Yep.
We know that narrative because that's who wrote it. And then you can even take it a step further and say the people who are training the AI, they're the ones who are the winners. And so now we're just seeing their views in the AI.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, because if you have that authoritative power, right, you could just go into the data and go, so any instance of the Titanic sinking, could you just change the date ever so slightly, just for all of that stuff? And now the Titanic is like sunk in a different year or suddenly in the future. You know what I mean? It's like, that is a serious power.
I think that's what people were pissed about with Musk. He did that on Grok, I think, where he was like, we're not going to use Wikipedia. It's bad data. We're going to use different Wikipedia, which is more real news, you know? And people are like, wait, so you're just rewriting history? That feels wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And weird.
And then you get this all sorts of madness happening with Grok on top of that.
Yeah.
You know,
Grok, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
But you're going to have, it reminds me of back in the day when the touch phones were becoming a thing. And at that point in time, I remember, I can't remember if it was like right when the iPhone came out or right before the iPhone came out, my friend told me, you know, there's going to be a proliferation of apps and you're not going to be able to use them all. So you're going to have to choose which ones you use. So there's going to be some people that like to use Facebook. There's going to be some people that like to use Twitter. There's going to be some people that like to use Snapchat, XYZ. And these apps are going to have their communities, their user base. And it's very much like that with the different AI camps right now, where you see, okay, but I also think that, yeah, just like with the app days, I'm trying to use all of them all the time to see which ones are good because it changes so quickly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So are you gravitating to a certain way of working at the moment, or is it still changing?
Oh, man, right now I am using a lot of Claude and Claude Code. I was really heavy on Gemini and Anti-Gravity. Then I found I can use Claude Code with inside of Anti-Gravity. And the thing is, though, Anthropic's been pretty sneaky lately about their pricing tiers and how you can use Claude Code in third-party apps, which doesn't give me the best warm and fuzzies. And so I'm thinking, well, maybe now is a good time to see if I can use Codex inside of these third parties. But it's not like Sam Altman gives me warm and fuzzies either. So you're kind of like choosing between all of these. The one that I have not touched at all is definitely Grok, because not for any specific reason, I guess you could say. It's just like, I find that Codex and Claude Code are so good that it's really hard for me to say, you know what, I need to go and also try another one.
Yeah, yeah.
So I haven't used, and for that reason too, I haven't really used any of the open source ones, although I do know a lot of friends that they live and die by the Kimi models. And that's their thing. But I'm sitting there and I'm like, I'm not ready for the side quest of renting a GPU and hosting an open source model on it for the time being.
Yeah, Yeah, yeah. But I noticed the other day, which was exciting to me, that there was a Apple Intelligence, right, ships a model onto your machine. And there's a GitHub repo called appfill. Which is a command line tool for interacting with the model that's already on your machine. And I was like, this is genius. It's crap. It's totally crap, but it's like genius. Like comparatively, you know what I mean? The model is, but like, I was like, oh, this is so cool. I could just like be offline and be using.
Yeah. Once it's an actual model that's valuable.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So that, I mean, that's just a quick way of doing it without like having the friction of the going for the process of setting these things up. Thank you so much for your time. We've unfortunately reached the end. I've got to jump off in a second, but how do people find you, talk to you, give you money, chat to you, all that sort of stuff?
I am not accepting any money these days. It's actually funny. This timing is very interesting because the MLOps community, we're just transitioning into becoming the main user community of the Agentic AI Foundation. So the MLOps community is merging with the Agentic AI Foundation, which is one of the fastest growing foundations of the Linux Foundation. There's over 190 members now, which is wild. And so that's where I'll be hanging out. Mm-hmm. I also am pretty active on LinkedIn in case you want to see some of my random, I wouldn't call it very value add posts, but hopefully they're entertaining.
Nice. Well, thanks very much for your time, and I'm sure we'll speak to you soon.
Hello, and welcome to the end of the episode. Thanks again to Demetrius for coming on. I always find Demetrius's energy really contagious, so it's really lovely talking to him and having his insights about the ML ops side of things. And for me, I find it really interesting that this area is kind of grappling almost with what used to be a way of working, getting ML models to production, basically, taking that whole pipeline and making it productionized. Now grappling with these ML services and how they fit into this equation and how that changes things is really interesting to think about. I also like the end there where we're talking about ground truth and this kind of one dimensionality of, you know, how you can subvert things if you are the owner of that service, and especially if a service becomes a monopoly. So it's, you know, these other ethical questions, moral issues come into it, and something that we've been grappling with all the way back since Siri and Alexa have, you know, become this one-dimensional chat thing, which doesn't always give you all the information, or doesn't, or by virtue of just being this one way of working, this chat thing, voice thing, not being able to give you all the different answers and giving you a plethora, a selection of things to choose from. Again, if you'd like to support the podcast, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your mum. You can find more from us at themachine-ethics.net. And if you can, you can always support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machineethics. Thanks again, and I'll speak to you next time.